Good morning. How's it going? Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, my father's birthday. Happy birthday, Dad. Father.
Happy birthday, Father.
It is my dad's birthday, 83. Good job, Pop. This is the I'm Sorry About Last Night podcast. This is the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Makes sense. Couldn't have done it any better. How's everybody doing? It's early, right? I mean, how bad could it be? How bad could it have gotten so far? Hopefully not so bad. It's a beautiful day. We're in the beautiful time of the year. It's fall. I personally really enjoy the fall. I kind of compare. It seems like everything that I look at in my life, I somehow compare to recovery, or just the continuous battle of good and not so good. No, not too much of one thing. You know, it's because of the fall that I appreciate the summer. You know, it's because of the winter that I appreciate the spring. You know, if it was all, I lived in San Diego at one point in my life, and it was so beautiful. It's just too much, you know, too much goodness for me. I can't just live in continuous happiness. I need to have some shitty weather. And, you know, that's what we get here in Delaware. You get a little everything. But I do like this time of the year. You know, I got some new jeans. I don't know. Here, I'll tell you a little secret if there's any fellas out there listening and you're looking for some good jeans, this is a secret, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you. Levi's 513s, the fucking best jeans ever. If you don't like them, tough shit. You should like them. Levi's 513s. I wear size 33-30. I'm a little short. God could have made me a 32. I've always said I should have been a little taller. 33-32, I think that would have been a cool pant size. But what I have is a 33-30. I'm just going to have to live with it. Could be worse, people. Great jeans, though. Let me look at them. Let me just take a look at these jeans right now. I just got them on. Okay, yeah. See, first of all, the fucking gold stitching in these jeans are fucking on point right here. I don't like white stitching. I like the gold stitching, okay? It's got a nice straight leg. I'm wearing my Sanuks, my little flat Sanuk shoes. Awesome. And my Pearl Jam t-shirt. I mean, listen, how much better can life get? And then you find some amazing jeans.
They shut down the Golden Sahara Hotel,
Vegas.
Jessica says it won't be long till they blow it all to hell. She's standing in the front yard, cut off some skin. Me and her brother, we've been friends since I can't remember when. And ain't that the way it's always been? Everybody sitting around waiting for the sun to come again.
I love Brandon Flowers. In a normal way. I love that guy's voice. You know, there was a time when I wanted to, the Killers they weren't new. Brandon Flowers, if you don't know, Brandon Flowers is a singer for the Killers. And the Killers were out on tour. And the Killers had been around for a little bit, but all of a sudden I'd gotten a wild Killers hair at my ass, and I decided I want to be a big fan of the Killers. They're a great band. I mean, I became a big fan, and I just, there was this one summer, and I'm like, I got to go see the Killers. Got to go see them. And I'm looking around online, of course, you know, checking out tour dates and opportunities. And they were playing the iHeartRadio tour or iHeartRadio concert in Las Vegas. And I was like, shit, there we go. And I was, you know, different world, different life back then. But we found tickets where we were going to go. We were looking to find tickets. I looked it up finally and I found out that the tickets were $2,000. I was like, what? And for one moment, I considered it. I don't have $2,000. I mean, I might have $2,000, but I definitely don't have $2,000 to buy a Brandon or a Killers ticket. What the fuck's the matter with me? So I was like, shit. Then I figured out that Brandon Flowers was playing in Albuquerque. So I guess Brandon Flowers was doing a solo tour and the Killers were getting together for one night for the iHeartRadio Vegas show. And I was like, well, shit, I want to see Brandon Flowers, really. So we got tickets. The tickets were like $75, if not $65. They weren't bad. They were cheap tickets. We saw Brandon at the Rainbow Theater on Route 66 on Central Avenue down in Albuquerque. That's not a joke either. That's where we saw him, the Rainbow Theater in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The place held 350 people. I mean, what a venue. Remember, I took a picture of the place before the show, and it had just finished raining, and the picture was of this building. And so if anybody knows, I'm a huge fan of Albuquerque. I grew up in Albuquerque. Love Albuquerque. That historical, you know, that was the road, Route 66. Not the very first road, but it was one of the main thoroughways to get us across the United States. Route 66, there's, you know, a lot of stories about it. And through Albuquerque, they turned it into Central Avenue. As a kid, I went to high school on Central Avenue. Rode the bus on Central Avenue, took the Central Avenue all the way up to where we lived. We had to ride the bus to get home. And it was really the Route 66. And so the Rainbow Room, Rainbow Theater is on Route 66, downtown Albuquerque, this small venue. It's probably been around for freaking 200 years. A lot of historical buildings and historical stuff going on downtown Albuquerque. It's one of those buildings that looked like it was probably like a mom and pop store and then maybe a hotel and then maybe a warehouse and then maybe, you know, it's probably been five or six things over the years. But now it's the Rainbow Theater. So I took this picture of it and there was this huge rainbow that came right in and in the picture because we met some friends that I had grown up with down in Albuquerque for the show and we were having dinner before the show. And one of the cool things and the funny thing about Albuquerque is this whole time that I lived in Albuquerque, I had never hung out downtown where we were actually hanging out at this moment. I was always up in the southeast corner of Albuquerque. You know, I did go to high school down on Central Avenue, but most of my world took place up in the southeast corner, kind of at the base of the mountains. And where we were at this night was down on Central Avenue, down over the freeway, down by the valley. Two different worlds. But we're hanging out, having dinner. And the cool thing that's going on in Albuquerque, and this I think is happening in a lot of cities, is that, or used to, I don't know what's going on now, but, you know, more of the downtown, the old town, the historical areas tend to get, at least they did in Albuquerque, they tend to get a little run down, you know. One of the weird things when we were there the last time is where I had lived in the southeast area of Albuquerque, there was a big, you know, like a mini strip mall. And they had like a Safeway. And I remember Little Caesars, when Little Caesars first showed up, they used to give you two pizzas. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but Little Caesars were in there, a Chinese restaurant. You know, just your basic, you know, strip mall corner family. And that part of town was hustling and bustling. My mom worked at the Safeway. It was booming. When we were there this time, that whole part of the city of basically Wantabeau and Central Avenue was dead. That strip mall where my mom had worked and where the Little Caesars had been was gone. And the which is very interesting. And so, but the point was, is that, you know, where the Central Avenue had been over the years, it kind of got run down. They had started pumping a lot of money into that area and trying to bring it back. So where we were ended up sitting and having dinner was this new area that was getting built up. And this happened to be across from the new refurbished or re-signed, rebranded Rainbow Theater. Actually, I think that's been around for a while. Actually, if I really want to get into it, I think we saw maybe Star Wars there as kids. My buddy John told me that. I don't particularly remember, but he said that we saw Star Wars at that. It was an old theater. Anyway, so we're hanging out, and I take this picture, and basically the rainbow is going, you know, directly into the ceiling of the Rainbow Theater. Damn, that was a long fucking story for just all that, right? Yeah, so I'm sitting here podcasting, and I see other people that podcast sitting out front in the parking lot, and I'm realizing that they thought that they were going to do a podcast, and yeah, that didn't work out. We didn't plan that very well, but I am not giving up my podcast. I'm going to stick with it. So I was looking, you know, it's interesting. I keep talking about, I bought a book, and I'm all freaked out about reading this Daily Reflections. You know, it's funny when people say, oh, I'm so scared, and then they do it. It's the same way. I'm nervous about reading this, but I'm going to read it. I mean, at this point, what's the point? I mean, what's the deal? Got to get through it, right? Yeah, September 23rd, I was an exception. I was special, but okay, here we go. He, Bill W., said to me gently and simply, "Do you think that you are one of us?" I'm not even going to read that. Hi, my name is Tom. I'd like to share. When I first came into the pro, what do they say? You only change until the pain stops. Is that fair? You only change until the pain stops. That means you only try to change your world until the pain stops, and then we usually stop. And that's always been my relationship with recovery. Even to this day, I could be and I could do a lot more, but I'm not in pain, so I stop. And that's how it's always been through my journey in this. You know, I get caught, I make a plan, I follow through with the plan for a little bit, and then, you know, the stress of getting caught fades away. My parents or wife or whatever it was, you know, their anger fades away, and then my real effort to fix anything or change my life kind of fades away. I never had any desire to get sober. I never had any desire to be one of you, one of them at a young age. I loved partying, but I didn't have a purpose. No purpose, no problem, let's party. I mean, we ran the streets. We had, if you lived and did what I did, you'd want to do that too. That was just so much fun. It wasn't really a problem. The only problem was is that I had a huge desire to love smoking pot. My parents hated pot. That was the problem. And that would be the foundation for all of my problems. I mean, that was the beginning, you know. And I didn't want to quit. So that made me an addict. Maybe they shouldn't have told me to quit. I have this, you know, I think about this with my son. Because eventually, you know, they've grown up around sobriety. But eventually, you know, these things are going to come creeping into their lives. And I often think of, you know, what the right way is to handle it. I don't know, that's probably a whole nother podcast. But, you know, that would be the beginning of me trying to balance between getting high and trying to be sober or lie about being sober. And my parents hated that stuff. And, you know, I'd get caught. I'd make amends. I remember going to meetings as a kid. going in, you know, it's like going to the dentist. You're just going because you have to. I have no desire, had no desire. You know, and I was thinking about this last night. This book that I bought is, I think it's based on, I think it's more NA, Narcotics Anonymous. And I don't know if I've ever said this, but I think really I'm a drug addict. First and foremost. I mean, I used to love pot. I was a huge fan of speed. Cocaine, not so much. Heroin, not so much. Basically, pot and speed. And then I eventually would use pills, but I don't even know what the fuck that was about. That was just like me being just sick. Like, I don't know, let's take it. Well, plus I was in pain, so there was a few parts of that one, but that would later on be part of it. But my alcoholism didn't really show up until I moved to Delaware, and I couldn't get those drugs. And I switched everything over to just alcohol because I could buy it and catch. It's so funny, like I could do speed or I could smoke pot. My parents and family would come apart, you know. But drink, everybody's all right with that, which just is weird. Still bizarro. But, you know, but I never had a lot of success through NA. NA seemed to be, I never had any success. I remember trying to go to NA. I'm like, well, I'll go to NA. I'm a drug addict. But it wasn't until I got sober off of alcohol and then joined AA that I was able to find kind of a niche or a little spot. And I don't know why, but I'm definitely a candidate for all these damn meetings. But the, you know, the point was is that, you know, we change until, you know, the pain goes away. And a lot of the times, you know, by my parents either, you know, letting me off the hook or whatever it was, they kind of allowed this behavior to go on. I mean, what would be the perfect reaction to this behavior? Just throw me out as a kid, you're out. Put me in an orphanage. I don't know. I mean, you got to deal with it. It says, during my drinking life, I was convinced I was an exception. I thought I was beyond petty requirements and had the right to be excused. I never realized that the dark counterbalance of my attitude was the constant feeling that I did not belong. At first in AA, I identified with others only as an alcoholic. What a wonderful awakening for me it has been to realize that if human beings are doing the best they could, then so was I. All of the pains, confusion, and joys they feel are not exceptional, but part of my life, just as much as anybody's. I got to read that again. During my drinking life, I was convinced that I was an exception. I thought I was beyond petty requirements and had the right to be excused. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense. I remember, you know, coming first into the program, you know, any suggestion I followed, you know, Ron M., you need to make the coffee. You need to be here 50 minutes early. You need to put out the cookies. You need to get the creamer. Yes, sir. You got it. You got it. But as the time went on, I think, and I've talked about this before, in my behavior, in my things that I would do to be normal, in my mind, I was feeling a little bit awesome. Like, oh my God, look at me. So awesome. And that made me feel like an exception, you know? So all of a sudden, I started, you know, not showing up early, you know, maybe not doing this. Not for a while. It took me a while. I was pretty fucked up when I got in this program, and I really did enjoy this new found life that I was living, which was just normal, just being a normal guy, you know, helping out, showing up, being reliable. But, you know, it makes you feel special. Like I'm an exception. And I thought I was beyond petty requirements. You know, and I think that's part of that same thing. You get into the program and time goes by and you get a few chips and some coins. And next thing you know, you don't need to be making coffee, right? Or whatever it is that we do. I never realized that the dark counterbalance of my attitude was the constant feeling that I did not belong at first. I mean, what is that saying? Like, you know, like, and this happens to me. I'll walk in a crowded room of people and, you know, right away I start assassinating people. Fuck that guy. Who's that fucking guy? Who does he think he is? And eventually I badmouth and criticize enough people, and then all of a sudden I start feeling like that I can fit in. And so I never realized that that dark counterbalance of my attitude was the constant feeling that I did not belong. And that makes a lot of sense. I'm fucking assassinating people because I'm not good enough in my mind. And how, what better way to be good enough or to fit in than to remove everybody that's making you feel that way? I identified with others only as an alcoholic. What a wonderful awakening for me it has been to realize that if human beings are doing the best they could, then so was I. You know, it's pretty a cool thing about these programs is that, you know, you're not like, hey, I'm Tom, I'm male, I'm an alcoholic. Hey, I'm Tom, I have a job, I'm an alcoholic. It's just, my name's Tom, I'm an alcoholic. We're all, that's what brings us together. That's what allows us and a desire to drink. You know, it doesn't matter if you're tall. Yeah, I love these meetings that, gay meetings, straight meetings, open meetings. I mean, I guess they're important, right? But was that part of the first meetings? You know, you just come in, and is that part of the traditions? When you look at the traditions, they always say if you want to start a meeting, just grab the traditions and head out. And in the traditions, it doesn't say that a meeting must have identified other ways other than just being an alcoholic. That's ego. That's people's personalities getting involved. Personalities over principles. It's principles over personalities, not the other way around. But there they are. And, you know, that's dangerous too. That's one of the things that there's a little bit of hypocrisy, and I'm not bad-mouthing anybody, but, you know, people say, well, you can't read the big book because you don't want to put it off in a way that may deter somebody from sticking around or coming in at all, right? But why do we label meetings? You know? I mean, if someone's struggling and holding on by the edge of the table, their nails are dug in, you know, they can get to it. They need to go to a meeting. And I think pretty much any meeting would allow you to come in. But, you know, some are labeled certain ways. And, you know, maybe I wouldn't go if that was the case. Why is that fair? I don't know. Probably isn't. But what are you going to do? What a wonderful awakening it is for me. Or what a wonderful awakening for me it has been to realize that. If human beings are doing what they do best, then... If human beings were doing the best they could, then so was I. All of the pains, confusion, and joys they feel are not exceptional, but part of my life, just as much as anybody's. You know, there's a, for me, it's constantly a balance of self and humility. I don't know a better way to say it. That's what I go through. And I was thinking about this last night. I don't know if humility is something that you get or if humility is a byproduct from something that you do. I think humility is a byproduct from something that you do. It's like setting, you know, going into a meeting. Someone said, hey, man, can you leave for me next week? And you're like, I can't. Because you're scared or whatever it is. Can't do it. Fine. So you show up in the meeting. Let's say the speaker had changed and they say, hey, can you do this? You know, and of course you're like, oh, you've always, you know, what do they say? You never say no. So you do it. And you speak and you fucking fumble your words and it's a real nightmare. And then you say, I think that's all I got. Thank you. And, you know, my name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. And the wave of relief that comes over me, I think most of us, but I know for me, it's a wave of relief because that self, because self's like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't speak. But the reality is that you do it. You work through that fear, and then that wall of self-centered fears comes down, and there's a whole nother world of peace and serenity that shows up. Maybe for just a second, maybe for 5 minutes. Maybe you get to sit in it for a little bit. But it's a byproduct of doing something really fucking shitty like speaking. I think that's what humility is. You know? Surrendering all of our thoughts, surrendering all of our positions on our thoughts, you know, what we think about meetings, this and that. You know, if we just put it all aside and just kind of go for it. Like, I can't go to this meeting. There's going to be people in there. Just do it. You decide to do it. You go in. After the meeting's over, you're like, oh my God, that was great. It's all you need, right? It's all you need. I don't know. I'm just bear with me. I'm just enjoying my chat. Just thinking it through, reading some stuff. You know, if you're struggling with sobriety, be honest. Do you really want to get sober? If you don't, that's fine. Right? I think anybody will tell you that. If you do not want to get sober, that's fine. The world around you may change, but that is absolutely fine. It's going to take that kind of thinking, that kind of choice, because to get sober, you're going to actually have to make the same kind of choice, but the opposite way and say, I do. But the first thing is, for me, was about being honest. Is this something I really want to do, or am I fucking trying to pull the fucking wool over the world's eyes one more time?
Rest. I wake up every morning and I wonder if I'm going to pass the test.
Have a great day.
Try to live up to what she's got in mind. Sometimes the pressure's so heavy, I feel like leaving it all behind me. Ain't that the way that it's always been? Laying low just long enough for the dust to settle down. The black and the white, the thick and the thin, and hoping that he's really got the power to save us from these sins. Everybody's sitting around waiting for the sun to come again. I took a long walk yesterday, yesterday, to a field where I used to play.